Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Susan Lindauer about 9/11, ISIS, and of course the massive mess that has been unfolding in the greater Middle East and the expansion of, you know, the conflict really, and how this is going to be drawn into other parts of the world. We're also talking a little bit about her book Extreme Prejudice that is available on Amazon.com. But before the break here, I asked you about this question in terms of, you know, the government dropped your prosecution in 2009, but before this, a judge ruled you mentally unfit to stand trial. Tell us what happened this and why you believe this occurred.
Yeah, this was a shocker. I was the chief asset covering Iraq at the United Nations. And after my arrest, I quickly recognized that I had a brilliant opportunity and a unique opportunity to confront the United States with the real facts of Iraqi pre-war intelligence and our knowledge of 9/11, and that I could conduct my own congressional inquiry right in a courtroom under subpoena power, because they had accused me of they'd written the indictment in certain ways that it would be impossible to keep out our advanced knowledge of 9/11, And the fact that they accused me of being an Iraqi agent, I had the right to call witnesses to prove that the peace option we had developed was actually for the advantage of the United States. So they could not keep out my evidence, my damning evidence. And they knew it too. It also would turn out that they had the evidence they were trying to use against me was very weak and meager. And like there were three, I'm not making this up, unfortunately, there were three lunches that I allegedly had with a diplomat in New York, totaling $92.92 in the most expensive city in the world, okay, and in Manhattan. And, and they wanted me to send me to prison for this for 10 years. If I had been sentenced on that charge alone was a 10-year sentence, and for $92.92. And these lunches were alleged to have taken place. Two of them were alleged to have taken place before 9/11, on September 8th and September 10th. And it was very material that I had a witness who was ready and willing and able to testify under oath, very credible witness, that I had told him about the 9/11 attack, and I had warned him to stay out of New York City because we expected an attack on the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they could not keep it out of court. So what they did was they said, well, we are not going to let you have a trial. They declared that I was incompetent to stand trial. That lined up beautifully with the dishonest claim that it was bad pre-war intelligence that misled poor Congress. These poor congressional leaders were misled into supporting war in Iraq. And if only the bad intelligence people like Susan Lindauer had provided us with quality intelligence, we would never have gotten into this mess. So don't blame us on Capitol Hill who pushed us into this catastrophe. Blame her.
Right.
You know, blame Susan for it. And so what they said was Susan is incompetent to stand trial. And I said, oh, like heck I am. I demand a trial. I fought them for it. I fought hard. I refused to back down. I was not obliging. I was not grateful. I was not sympathetic. I was madder than heck, and as mad as I've ever been, that they had figured out how to thwart me to stop the truth from coming out. And if I'd had a trial, if I'd had due process of law, you might have convicted me. A jury of my peers might have decided that, well, we agree with the Justice Department. She's a foreign agent and she should be convicted. But I would have been able to prove who I was and what I had been doing. And it would have changed everything. So as a result of being declared incompetent to stand trial, I was ordered to surrender to Carswell Prison on Carswell Air Force Base in Texas. And you all know the reputation, I think, of Texas being very conservative, you know, fairly dumb. George Bush is from Texas. I rest my case. Okay. And these people were the stupidest, backwards ignoramuses running this prison that I've ever seen. It was on a military base. So I was subjected to all kinds of troubles. I was denied the right to have an attorney visit. My uncle tried to visit me to help negotiate a settlement and solve my problems, and they refused to let him onto the base so that I would have a family or attorney visits. It took he had to come three times, and on the third time, U.S. Marshals were standing by at the gate to force his way in. That's what it took. So I have been through what they call the NDAA, I was threatened with indefinite detention for up to 10 years with no right to a trial or hearing, because I was like adamant, especially because I was locked up in prison. This was not a minor problem. This was not a cosmetic inconvenience. This was no longer slander. This was no longer just a little lie they were telling. Now I was in prison, and they were fighting like the devil to lock me up for 10 years with no trial or hearing. No hearing. Try to imagine that. And not only that, they wanted to forcibly drug me with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac, because I was supposed to be incompetent to stand trial. The government was in this obscene position of having the right to demand that I should be made competent to stand trial. And I was like, well, wait one second here. I'm already competent to stand trial. You don't have to, you know, nobody's got to drug me. I'm not a schizophrenic. I'm not a hallucinating person. They're like, but you suffer from this delusion that you warned about 9/11 and you were a CIA asset covering Iraq. And until you stop saying that you were a CIA asset, we have to drug you so we can cure you. And essentially what they wanted to do was chemically lobotomize me. But of course, these were Texas psychiatrists. These were very, very, very corrupt, dishonest people. I have no respect for the psychology business at all. They prostituted their credentials to George Bush, of all people. I call Carswell my own private Guantanamo, because it was as ugly as you. I was as close to an enemy non-combatant as anybody at Gitmo, with the difference that I was an American citizen. But they were out to, they had to just, once they locked me in prison, they believed that I had to be destroyed and annihilated, because eventually I would get out and somebody was going to hear my story, and they were going to realize that the Bush administration had falsified the reports about 9/11 in Iraq. And the tragedy was, of course, that the corporate media did not care.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a little bit more about that later. But, you know, by the way, Susan, I know some very intelligent and courteous, nice Texans, and I don't think anyone who joins the military, wherever they are, who is willing to fight wars for Israel is very clever, wherever they're in America or somewhere else. But, I'm not one who falls for the Hollywood Zionist stereotype that all Texans are, you know, backward rednecks that are racists who have low IQ and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's a big shame that Americans who are pro-liberty and pro-gun, who are, known for having a strong rebellious spirit, are being portrayed in this way, who actually could help to put up a fight against the tyrannical globalist government. So I, for one, think that there is a reason why they demonize Texans in this way. And unfortunately, a lot of people fall for that. But on a separate note, we know that they don't want things to end up in court, nonetheless, due to what might come out. This might be the cat comes out of the bag, if you will. But how did they perform? Did they do a psychological evaluation of you? Did the judge just come to this conclusion themselves, or what happened there?
They claimed they did a psychological evaluation of me before I was sent to Carswell. I was ordered to take an ink blot test. Okay.
Yeah.
an inkblot test. And I said, this is stupid. I refuse to do it. I want my trial. My life is good. I stand by my values. I believe in what I did, and I'm ready to, I am willing to pay the consequence for what I did, but I believe that there needs to be a trial for the sake of the country. And this is, they were like, oh, you're grandiose. She thinks the world needs to hear what she has to say. She thinks that the American people need to know the real facts of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. And so the psychiatrist went crazy on that, saying, what grandiosity that she thinks that a trial is good for this country. We're not going to let you have a trial under any circumstances. I mean, that's the kind of crazy stuff I was dealing with.
Right, right. Now, let me just play devil's advocate here a little bit, and I want to take it from the point of view of what some people might think when they hear this. And I want to ask you how they kind of treated you in prison and whatnot, because, you know, I know some people out there, they think, you know, one CIA, always CIA, that kind of idea, right? And they even have their suspicions about people, how they're treated in prisons when they're hauled off and whatnot. But if, let's say, we have listeners who are there for that reason, you know, suspicious of, let's say, your testimony or anything you have to say, what would you say to those people?
Well, I was in real prison. You know, the CIA is like the mafia. Once you're in, you're always in. You're never allowed to. They had to kill me off. And that's what these are the rules. I mean, the rules of intelligence are that anything is fair game. If they, you know, there are no rules. The first rule is that there is no rule. And that they if you can't play in that world of like a rugby match, you know, it's like a knockdown, drag out brawl where they will use whatever method is necessary to kill you off and shut you up. I will tell you that under no circumstances should Julian Assange and Edward Snowden ever be allowed to come to the United States for trial. Never under any circumstances should they come here for trial, because they would be there would be no due process of law. It's not a question of whether they'd get the death penalty. All of the rights that Europeans associate with the trial would be stripped away. The jury is not allowed to in a Patriot Act case, the jury is not allowed to question the lack of evidence. The prosecutor is allowed to instruct the jury that the federal government has secret evidence, which the federal government believes proves the case, and therefore the jury is not allowed to, the federal government, is the Justice Department, is fully in its rights to deny the jury the right to see it. And pretty much the jury must be instructed to convict.
Yeah.
They are instructed to convict. If they do not convict, then they are not patriots. It's a very hard argument if you're a defendant, but I would have been a good case for this because I was not an Arab male. I do not have brown skin. I am blonde and white, and I look like a soccer mom. I am not the one that they intended to make the. I am not a poster child for why we need the Patriot Act. I'm a poster child for why the Patriot Act should be thrown out on its ear.
Yeah, well, that's changed too in the last few years. Now they're looking for white Al Qaeda and everything else, and now even regular Americans are the terrorists.
Yes.
You know, as we know.
That's right.
So they've certainly changed the entire environment and what seemed to began as this kind of really ramping up of putting all the blame on Islam has kind of shifted throughout the years, which is very interesting. But one note there as well is that, as we know, which is a very dangerous one, is that they can declare anyone insane basically and forcefully medicate them or lobotomize them chemically, whatever they want to do. But with NDAA, as you mentioned, with the Patriot Act and all these other laws and things have gone into place since 9/11. They basically, they've made it legal to break the law. Basically, it's a way to circumvent everything that at least you guys in America have been, privy to when it comes to your constitution and everything else. So it's not that it's illegal per se, but really these laws have been designed to circumvent it. So how do Americans combat these kinds of problematic issues that the government now is the most tyrannical force there for you guys, and how do you suggest the people can break out of that.
Well, it is a very scary thing. My case, when I first brought my story out, people presumed, even thinking people, smart people, presumed the government must be right. I must be insane because George Bush told them so. Why would George Bush lie to anybody? Why would the Justice Department, why would Alberto Gonzalez, the former attorney general, why would he lie to me, to us, to the world? It was even difficult for anyone to conceive that such things would be possible. But through my story, at least in the blog community in America, there is now a desperation, a desperate knowledge, a desperate awareness that we are all in a great deal of danger, and that in a way it's worth it, because I wanted something good to happen from my story, and it woke people up. It shook people awake that they must not be compliant and complacent, thinking that don't worry, these laws only apply to somebody else. Now they are aware because of my story. And to be honest with you, I think I'm the only one who's free right now, who was originally arrested on the Patriot Act. I'm one of the only people who's actually out of prison because my case was so outrageous, and because they did refuse to give me a trial and they did declare me incompetent. And then the judge in my case, and this is to show you the corruption factor. My judge was Michael Bucasey, who later became U.S. Attorney General after Alberto Gonzalez. Well, it turns out Michael Bucasey also, at the same time as he was hearing my case, was also hearing Larry Silverstein's insurance claims for the World Trade Center. And my attorney and Larry Silverstein's rich, powerful attorneys were crossing in the hallways, coming in and out of court together. Very much collusive, I believe. I believe my public defender sold me out for them, and that he essentially fell on his sword for them to help them out. They were all excited until I started fighting back. But they literally, I would be brought into court while his attorneys were walking out of court, and I would be in shackles saying, "Your Honor, we knew about 9/11. We knew about 9/11. I tried, you know, I personally contacted the office on, I can tell you the date, on August 8th, a month before 9/11. I personally contacted the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft and told him that we were seeking asking for an emergency, what we call an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies, seeking any fragment of intelligence involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center with the possible use of a miniature thermonuclear device. I believe that my story was propagating throughout the intelligence community so that the Bush administration, before the attack, our team, because we were connected to Iraq, we were part of the whole education, the pre-planning, preconditioning. This is so hard for you guys to understand, that the intelligence community, that there were puppet masters who were using our team to precondition the other intelligence community to accept war with Iraq as an inevitable conclusion of the 9/11 attack. And this was going on for months, and it was stronger because I was so anti-war and because I was pushing the Iraqis so hard to give us intelligence on the attack. And then I also went to the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft and asked for this emergency broadcast alert, which meant that there was mid-level strong sharing of intelligence. This became a problem, because how do you say that bad intelligence resulted in the 9/11 attack when in fact The intelligence was very strong, and it was very, very accurate, strong and accurate, according to the official scenario. And then you have the problem of the fact that you have the, how do you explain the bombs? If you put a bomb on a commercial airliner, they're going to find it. So the bomb had to be in the buildings. Well, how are you going to get the bomb into the buildings? How's Al-Qaeda supposed to get the bomb into the buildings?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
See, it doesn't make sense. And as soon as you start looking at it, you realize that 9/11 required two things. There's no intelligence failure. None. Zero. Which means that two things had to happen for a successful attack. One, because the intelligence network was so strong, they had to pull off, like in the Kennedy assassination, they had to pull off the protections. They had to peel away the protective protocols that would kick in automatically. With NORAD, for example, NORAD had procedures for what to do with enemy aircraft flying through U.S. airspace. These protocols have existed forever. What are you going to do? NORAD was then diverted to the Pacific Northwest for training exercises from September 10th to September 12th. There's a training exercise going on all the way across the other side of the world. So that only, and then they are told that if they hear of anything, it's not real. Don't worry, it's part of the training exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was a decision. That is an active decision. You see, it's not like they let it happen. You have to make it happen. Because the intelligence people, because 95% of the intelligence community would throw themselves on top of the bomb. The people I knew would have done anything to stop the 9/11 attack. But it only takes 20 people or 10 people to go rogue and 10 people at the top of the government in the highest levels of power to pull off the protections that automatically kick in. It requires an executive intervention. And then to stop the protections from going into place. And then it requires an active team to go into the World Trade Center and place the bombs where the bombs need to be to bring down the tower so that the magician trick will succeed. And that's what it was. It was a magician trick. All eyes were on the airplanes flying across the tower, across the water, into the towers, crashing into the towers, and then the dumb American people, the dumb people in Europe, the dumb idiots in all over, the whole planet, dumb idiots, all of us, every one of us a fool, looking at the magician trick saying, oh, gosh, the airplane hit the tower. That must be why the building crashed. And if anybody had done their jobs in the corporate media, that would have fallen apart immediately. Mm-hmm. It's a stupid story. How could you be so dumb as to believe that? If you believe that story, you have got the government you deserve.
Yeah.
If you're really stupid, if you're so stupid, I mean, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to be nice about it. If you believe that story, you're stupid. That's an idiot story. You have to, I mean, of course there were bombs and explosives. The question becomes, how did they get into the building? Because they sure couldn't get onto the airplane. The original story was that the hijackers would carry the nuclear bombs. Think about this. This was the original story, was that the hijackers would carry the nuclear bombs onto jetliners that they would hijack, and somehow they would get the nuclear bombs on board without anybody in security noticing it. Well, that's just dumb. That's another stupid thing. So then the bombs had to get into the buildings. Well, how did the bombs get into the buildings? Oh, because we put them there. You know, see, it's just, yeah. I'm dumbfounded that people could be that stupid, but they apparently they are. They're very complacent. They're very happy to accept it.
Yeah. Well, as we know, you know, when these traumatizing, very large scale events occur, people become they do become pacified, and we know about the psychology of basically applying whatever, you know, anyone who has some kind of ounce of authority tells you. It is a kind of a mind control, you know, event, really, because, you know, due to the fact that how most humans react. So they've certainly used that, you know, to their advantage to tell people whatever they can, basically, about the plan. You would think, though, that many, many years later, they would be capable of receiving this in some kind of way. But I think it's just the very aspect that it is of such monumental, you know, scale, and the fact that a lot of these other consequent things hinges on this is something that divert people away from it, and they can't look at it. It's too scary, you know. So
yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I really do. I think it's, but it's something that we need to realize that, you know, I think we need to, especially because of what's happening with ISIL today. You know, we have created this problem. This is what we call blowback. And I know a lot of your listeners understand what blowback is, but let me tell you, for those who don't know, blowback is when an intelligence operation goes wrong and there are unintended consequences, and the American people or the global community are faced with the consequences, but they don't understand the source because the operation has been concealed from them. Okay.
Yeah.
The original operation is concealed, and then the world community, the onlookers, are confronted with the consequence of the operation, and they're like, "What happened? How did this horrible thing go wrong? How did it go this wrong?" Well, there's no excuse for us because we know 9/11 was a fraud, and the dangerous thing is that ISIL, Al-Qaeda, was created by the CIA. It's Al-Qaeda. It really is. It was Al-Qaeda all the way. Mohammed Atta was a CIA recruit. He was trained, funded by the CIA. He and Israel. And he was not a devout jihadi. He gambled, he drank, he whored, he went to strip joints. This is not how a true Muslim, anybody, behaves. No way. Islamic jihadis do not go to strip clubs and use cocaine and drink alcohol and smoke.
Right.
They don't. Impossible. They do not gamble. They consider those killing offenses. They will flog you if you do it. They will, if after two or three times, they will actually kill you outright. So there's zero talk. It's not possible. It's just not possible. The official story is completely wrong. But now we have ISIL, who recognizes that the United States wants, these are emasculated Arab men. They have no future. They perceive to have no future. They perceive that the world looks down on them, and they want to fight back and assert their masculinity. They've been degraded. A lot of the Iraqis were held in horrific conditions in prisons like Abu Ghraib. And do not think that ended just because they arrested because the United States sent some of those people to jail. The conditions at Abu Ghraib persisted over 13 years, and now those Iraqi fighters have become free, and the Iraqi detainees who were not political before are political now, and they are, if ISIS is going to give them an identity of strength, then that's what they're going to reach for, and that's what they don't necessarily care about Islamic identity. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. They want to be on the winning side.
Yeah.
And we have created this monster ourselves. We are to blame. And if you want to know who's to blame, we are to blame.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more and some of the backdrop to this, because we've touched upon it before, but we need to go back there and discuss. You know, we know about the project for the New American Century, and we know some of the people involved in this, but, you know, it comes out of a different environment in terms of, we know the neocons, we know that they come out of a group called the New York Intellectuals, and there is a backdrop to the project for the American New Century, which is such that it's basically just an update on a very much older plan, which is called the Yinian plan, you know, for Greater Israel, where they openly talking about Syria, Iraq, and getting these countries involved, Jordan, as an expansion of Israel. What is this that maybe regular Americans don't understand when it comes to a religious backdrop to this? Because the, you know, whether people like to admit that or not, a lot of the people who are involved as the neocons, they're Jewish. The Project for the New American Century, a lot of them, Robert Kagan, William Kristol, you know, Elliot Abrams, David Epstein, all these people, they're what is the possibility here that they have a religious background to this, and this is how they're using the military?
Absolutely. This is everything, if you follow it back, cui bono? Who benefits? It's Israel. And it all comes back to that. Everything, all the tangle goes back to Israeli efforts to manipulate the United States into, they're using up the American century and exploiting it to redefine the Middle East in an image that will keep Israel's enemies down and Israel up. And that's what, and they will sacrifice anything, any sacrifice that no sacrifice is too great, and including the American taxpayer, the American middle class. We are bankrupt. Our middle class is broken. Our military is broken. I mean, we have no money to pay for health care, for benefits for veterans who are suffering from traumatic injuries. We have no money for pensions, but we have money for the military-industrial complex to go fight more wars against ISIL.
Yeah, and look at even how much, I mean, we looked at yesterday, we're working on a couple of videos on this, but just the foreign aid alone, and a lot of this is, of course, in military expenditures to, you know, Egypt, to Israel, to Afghanistan, to, you know, all of these countries are getting tremendous amounts of money as America is crumbling from the inside. And these people don't care about this because they don't have, their allegiance is not with America. They're using this as a kind of a, you know, this is the fist that is out there, you know, racking around. But whoever, if the host dies later, these people don't care about it.
Yes, that's right. That's absolutely right.
Now, if you bring attention to this, then in terms of the fact that there might be a different ethnicity, it might be a different religious ideology at the backdrop of this, they bring out the anti-Semitic card right away and say, you're not allowed to criticize these people.
Oh, yes. And that's nonsense. We've got to stop buying that. We've just got to put a stop to it and say, we're not going to play that game with you anymore. We're not going to pretend that this has anything to do with the Holocaust, has nothing to do with it at all.
Yeah. But this is how they're playing it, and people are kind of
it's a guilt thing. Sure, yeah. It is. And I've given speeches, and I've had Jewish people come to me and say, "Well, what about my poor relative? Like, will I back down?" I'm like, "No, it has nothing to do with your poor relative." You know, this is. But they are, and this is this is the crazy part of it, and this is why I keep talking about what the real purpose of this region-wide conflict is. ISIS has been going to all of these fighters, and they are not all radical Islamic fundamentalists. They are a coalition of fighters, and the end game is not Syria. The end game is Israel, and we are at a state right now where Israel has set this up so that it's going to get smashed.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It is going to get smashed now. So,
yeah, it's understandable. You keep meddling with people's affairs in this way, and it's not only America; it's in Europe too. A lot of the foreign policy of Britain and stuff like this. We a tremendous amount of Zionist lobbying going on in these countries, and they have their own, you know, Jewish European Union and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's very important for people to realize wherever they are on the fence in terms of these discussions and whatnot, doesn't really matter. We have to realize the fact that the foreign policy of the West in these days are not run by American or European or Western interests in that regard. And I think that's a lot of the disconnect. And unfortunately, then, we are now creating a scenario where the hatred for Arabs and the Arabs' hatred for, you know, Westerners are building up, and we have a third party in this equation kind of taking a step back and perhaps is very happy over the fact that these people are now fighting over something where they can step in after when this is said and done and just, you know, grab whatever territory they want. So I'd hate to see something like that occur here, you know?
I think it is going to happen. I think that I think we are now at a stage where I think it's too late to stop it. I think that payback's a bitch, and that's what's coming right now. All of this is blowback. The United States, you know, look at how we prosecuted Bradley Manning. The people want ignorance, and they stupidly believe that if you're ignorant, that the consequences are not real. If reality never took place, then you've created an alternative reality, in which case we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. But in fact, they are striking against our brutality, our viciousness, our savagery, and they are rising to match us. And that's horrible. I'm against ISIL. Nobody should think that I'm in favor of beheadings or that I'm justifying what they've done. But we have created this monster. And if I'd like to just spend the last few minutes just saying what needs to happen right now is to have a massive global arms embargo. Everybody stop sending weapons to everybody else. No more arms shipments will be allowed to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has been sending them to ISIL as well as to, you know, Saudi Arabia is a big problem in this factor. And that means that the military-industrial complex is going to have to go cold turkey. They're not going to get any more money from anybody. They're going to have to give it up. And we're going to have to do, you know, the only purpose, the single most important purpose of U.S. Navy ships should and U.S. Army should be to conduct search and seizures to stop the flow of weapons into the Middle East. And all weapons should be cut off. No matter who they're going to, it should be cut off. Everything's got to stop. And if we don't stop it right now, then Israel's going to have the big war that they want, that they've been afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Because ISIS is going to, the worst thing that could happen, God forbid you kill President Assad. He is the last, he is holding his country together. He is a unifying force that is stopping a war on Israel. But once he's gone, it would be like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. We may all hate Archduke Ferdinand. He may be terrible. You may hate Assad. You may think he's terrible. But if he's gone, then the real war, then the next stage of war will start almost immediately, because they don't care about Syria. Nobody cares about Syria. The Arabs are all looking at Tel Aviv and Haifa, and that's what they want. And so we are now at a point where we're going to have a global Middle East conflagration. And I would like to say, are you ready to have a European draft? I know that in America, the United States, we do not want a draft. But if we have to have a war at this scale, it is inevitable that your sons and daughters and my sons and daughters are going to have to go fight in this mess. And so we are going to, all of our treasure, the last treasure we have, will be squandered on a hideous, catastrophic war that will destroy our planet. And everyone's going to have to sacrifice their children. And so you need to stop and think, would you rather your kid go to university and get a job as a doctor or teacher or engineer, building up the society, or are you ready to have your kid killed off? And if they're lucky, come home with an amputation, head injury, paralysis, post-traumatic stress, because that's the future. It is a stark choice, and we are making it right now. So I think for myself, I say cut off the arms embargo, you know, impose an arms embargo right now. We did this. We created this problem ourselves. They are responding to us. This is a blowback situation. We may not understand all the abuses and hideous things that we did to the Iraqi people, but I guarantee you there is a reason why they're all uniting with ISIL.
Mm, yeah. Well, of course. I mean, if your country is being threatened, if your people are being threatened, and I know there's a lot of different factions within here fighting with each other, etc. But nonetheless, I think it's perfectly understandable. It's defense on a charge and an attack. So I would do the same thing. You know, it's just what it is. But how important is it, do you think, as a strategic move here, for the American people to try whatever they can to get control over their own country? I mean, the powers we've been talking about here now, who set, you know, the AIPAC is setting the policy, who in turn pulling the strings of the American government, who in turn gives orders to the American military. And what we've seen so far is that if we do have, and I think some of these are not independent and spontaneous, you know, some of these uprisings and rebellions that we've seen, but nonetheless, let's, you know, take even an aspect of like that Scotland is voting to try to get independent, what have you. If you had to have any nation or small region within the country that would break off, try to break out of the world hegemony that we're seeing, I think they would be smashed by, you know, if it was NATO or American run, something would come in that would take care of business here. And that's why it's so important for, you know, the American people here, you know, to step in there.
I think, though, that let me just tell you, for example, we're about to have major congressional elections in November, this new November 2014, no one is going to vote. Everyone in America is so disappointed, so disillusioned, so disenchanted. And the people, the members of Congress are the same old crooks on either side of the party lines. They're all bad. They're all mediocre. There, no courage, no vision, no leadership. No one has a plan for how to solve our problems, because the only thing they know how to do is create a war situation. It's like they have a hammer and they have a nail, and the nail is military-industrial complex, and the hammer is, you know, financing for the bombs. Buy the bombs, create jobs. It's the only thing America makes now is weapons. And this is corporate welfare. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to pay for schools. They don't want to pay for education or healthcare. God forbid you have Obamacare. God forbid you have single-payer healthcare. Oh, even worse than Obamacare would be single-payer healthcare. You know, I'm being facetious here. Mm. But they desperately crave, covet the money for their defense programs. Mm-hmm. And the military has, you know, God bless General Dempsey. He is a one-man crusade against war. He is fighting so hard to stop war in Iran. And he has just put down his foot and he said, until now, until ISIL came along, General Dempsey was winning. Because he said, our soldiers are exhausted. Our military is broken. We cannot have another deployment. It cannot happen. We don't have, and we're financially, we're broke. So what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we have the IRS. My little book money was just garnished by the IRS because they're so desperate for money. They're going after poor people. we can't pay our tax bills because we're too poor. So the IRS is seizing everything we have. Well, it's going to be the end of the middle class.
Yeah.
You know, we have a foreclosure crisis in the United States. Everything is falling. It's in free fall. People are thinking, people do believe, and I believe ISIL will do this, that there will be a major terrorist attack, probably on New York City, probably involving some kind of miniature thermonuclear device. We can all see the writing on the wall. We all know that eventually it's going to happen. But when it does, America lacks the capability to rise up. We don't have the strength of character that Europe has. You have endured and transcended hell. You've clawed your way out of the abyss after World War I and World War II, after the Middle Ages, after the Black Death, you know, after the Dark Ages. You've come through the Inquisition. You know what I'm saying? You've come through. You have a character. You have a history that you know that we don't have. We've never been tested. We've never had to build ourselves back up again.
Well, unfortunately, America has turned into that kind of globalist puppet state, really, of the new experimentation of just a hodgepodge. And unfortunately, people haven't looked and preserved much of their own, heritage and culture in America, and looking back to the European past. So I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. It may sound almost trivial to say it, but when it falls, America's collapse. And here's the tragedy. We all expect it to collapse. When it does, the only way that our leaders know how to get out of a collapse is to go to war.
Yep.
And that is going to, it's like this, for me, it's like a corkscrew, a downward spiral corkscrew, digging the grave deeper. But the only, you're going to have excessive unemployment that's going to have to be solved. You're going to have a draft to fight this war. But then you're going to have all these young people with no jobs. And if you kill off half the young people, well, then you've solved a lot of your problem.
Yeah, well, it's...
I don't believe that myself. Don't go out and say, Susan's with the PNC, the Project for New American Century.
No, I got you.
I'm horrified by it. I am anti-war. I am strongly, passionately anti-war. And I say to you again, if you don't stop this right now and create an immediate arms embargo, this is where you're going.
Yep, I agree. This is what the forces controlling America want. You know, they'd love to see it destroyed. We could go on and talk for much longer here, but I guess in a kind of a last question for you here, Susan, and it is kind of a big topic, but considering what we just spoken about and the potential collapse of, you know, America in this scenario, there are, of course, other forces that would kind of seek to rush in to kind of fill that void, if you will. And one of those, of course, is Russia. What do you think about Russia in this equation and their role and what they've been doing in terms of, you know, helping to...
I love President Putin.
Yep.
I love Putin. A lot of you people in Europe will be really mad at me for saying that.
I don't think so. Not this audience. Not this audience.
I love the people in Donetsk and the people of Crimea who voted for freedom from their voted in a public referendum to separate and create an autonomous region away from the central Ukrainian government. That is the way it should be done.
Yeah, I agree.
And the United States has no right ever to refuse to respect that vote. So I support Putin.
You know, I think you're right. I think that's actually the wave of the future. We published an article a couple of days ago here from one of the defense magazines or whatever, but they spoke about, in the context of what we've seen in Scotland, but there's other parts in the world, Britain, in France, you have, of course, the Basque region and all this stuff, but they talked about how decentralized power, in not globalism and all that, will actually help to shape the 21st century. I think we're going to see more type of secession, and even when America collapse, we're going to see a breakup into many different smaller regions. Well, and I think it's great, actually.
I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you, and I think it's going to happen sooner than you think. I think in 5 years, I think it will. I think Hillary Clinton, I do predict that Hillary Clinton has a very strong election bid in 2016. But by 2020, by the end of her first term of office, I think you're going to see this happen. I think by that time, you're going to see this happen. You're going to see the United States collapse.
And finally, there would be some kind of true diversity when it comes to political choice and differences of political structures and economic systems and everything else. And it's like, why not? You know, we've tried to amass centralized power for how long now, and it's just the more we try, the worse it gets. You know, European Union has completely run over the independent countries and etc. So
yes,
it's not the way to go. You know, not the way to go.
That's right. So thank you very much. I hope this was a good, I hope this is a good interview. I hope you're happy.
We've enjoyed it very much. Thank you so much. Please mention your book again for people where they can read the rest of the story and much else that you have to offer there. And if you do have any websites or anything you want to give out, Twitters or Facebooks or whatever, please go ahead and do that.
Sure. My book is called Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of Iraq and 9/11. It's available on Amazon. There's a French version as well, and I and it's on Kindle, so you can get it locally in Europe.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening today. We hope you learned something new, some important testimony here from an insider with some well, sadly predictable outcomes considering what we know about those running these wars. By the way, we have more shows coming up. Dennis Fetchel, Tim Murdoch, and Veronica Clark is with us next. And then later ahead, we also have John DeNugent, Matthew Tate, Tracy Twyman, Laird Scranton, and many more. Well, I hope you have a good weekend, folks, and we'll speak to you here in just a few days again. So take care, be well, and keep inquiring and asking questions.